Is that loud over there? Is it a heater on?
I don't know. I didn't put it on.
Do you like it on, or should we turn it off?
Yeah, thank you. I've got hearing losses, so if something is too loud, I'll go with the flow. People might want to come somewhere.
So, hi, good morning. So we have been reading through the parasha. Do you guys know what parasha means? It's a portion of scripture that you read through the first five books of the Bible every year. And this is what they do in Jewish synagogues all over the world. It starts and ends on the same day. But in Jesus' day, they had smaller portions. And so it didn't take 1 year. It took like 3.5 years. And so they have these old manuscripts of portions that date back. I mean, the manuscripts were found in Cairo, Geniza, maybe in the 9th century. I mean, the manuscripts themselves date older, but they go back in time. They preserve a tradition that is from around Jesus' time. And the reason it's interesting is because there are certain, in the first five books, each portion is matched with a portion in the prophets that go together somehow. And today, if you were to read through the whole parasha, you wouldn't find Isaiah 53. You wouldn't find a lot of things in Isaiah. But if you go back in the portions they read in Jesus' day, you do find these passages. And so it's been interesting for us to go to the older system and read through it. And also just to imagine what Jesus and his disciples would have done during the week. It would have been sitting and discussing the weekly portion. So that's what we've been trying to do, and it's taken us years. We take sometimes breaks for other things, but we've been looking. We're now in the book of Numbers, and we're just finishing the book of Numbers, and then we have one more book in Deuteronomy. And so first we read through at a table, we just read through the whole portion from Numbers, and then the portion that was connected to it. And then we ask ourselves a question, why? Why were these two passages connected? And how does reading them together influence how we read it? This week's portions are kind of, most people would skip them, let's put it that way. But since we're being purist here and we go through everything, we're going to go ahead and read them. So I'll show you where we are. We're in Numbers 33. Oh, this pen isn't very good, is it? And it's matched with Isaiah 11. The other interesting thing we've noticed as we've been doing this study is how often Isaiah is the one matched with the Torah. And that is true in Jesus' time. You'll notice in the New Testament, there are many, many references to Isaiah. Like some of the most often referred to books are Isaiah, Psalms, and Deuteronomy. So it's interesting, and this is true even in Qumran. You've heard of Qumran?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the amount of scrolls they find there and the way people were focusing, it was also a lot was focused on Deuteronomy and Isaiah and Psalms. So it's interesting. It shows us that this is an old pairing of texts. Okay, so it's Numbers 33, and it's been paired with Isaiah 11, 16. 16 and following. So we're going to read the whole chapter of Numbers 33. Believe it or not. And if, do you have English here or Swedish? So we'll start with Sheila. She'll read some. You have some? You have a... And then if you want to read in English, read. If not, then the next person will read. We'll just keep going. Go ahead, Sheila.
Wanderings from Ethiopia. These are the journeys of the Israelites who went out of the land of Egypt by their divisions under the authority of Moses and Aaron. Moses recorded their departures according to their journeys by the commandment of the Lord. Now these are their journeys according to their departures. They departed. departed from Ramses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month, on the day after the Passover, the Israelites went out defiantly in plain sight of all the Egyptians. Now the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord had killed among them. The Lord also executed judgment on their gods. The Israelites traveled from Ramses and camped at Sukkoth. They traveled from Sukkoth and camped at Etham, which is on the edge of the wilderness. They traveled from Etham and turned again to Pi Hahiroth.
Pi Hahiroth, yeah.
Which is before Baal Zephron, and they camped before Migdal. They traveled from Pi Hahiroth, and passed through the middle of the sea into the wilderness, and went 3 days' journey in the wilderness of Etham, and camped at Marah. Pick up
9.
Just read a chunk, whatever you think.
All right.
Oh, sorry.
You moved from Marah and came to Gilead, and then the chose springs of water and 7 palm trees. So they camped there. You moved from Gilead to and camped by the Red Sea. You moved from the Red Sea and camped in the wilderness of Sin. They journeyed from the wilderness of Sin and camped at Dokkah. They departed from Dokkah and came to Alush. They moved from Alush and camped at Rephidim, and were there. Where there was no water for the people to drink. They departed from Rephidim and camped in the wilderness of Sinai. They moved from the wilderness of Sinai and camped at Kibroth Hathaavah. They departed from Kibroth Hathaavah and camped at Haseroth.
Go ahead.
They left Haseroth and camped at Rithmah. They left Rithmah and camped at Rimmon Perez. They left Rimmon Perez and camped at Libna. They left Libna and camped at Risa. They left Risa and camped at Kehilatha. They left Kehilatha and camped at Mount Shepha. They left Mount Shepha and camped at Haradah. They left Haradah and camped at Makaloth. They left Makaloth and camped at Tahath. They left Tahath and camped at Terah. They left Tara and camped at Mithka. They left Mithka and camped at Hashmona. They left Hashmona and camped at Moseroth. They left Moseroth and camped at Bene-Jakon. They left Bene-Jakon and camped at Hor-Hagidah. They left Hor-Hagidah and camped at Jotbatha. They left Jotbatha and camped at Abronah. They left Abronah and camped at Ezion Geber. Oh gosh. They left Ezion Geber and camped at Kadesh in the desert of Sin. They left Kadesh and camped at Mount Hor on the border of Edom. At the Lord's command, Aaron the priest went up Mount Hor where he died on the first day of the fifth month of the 14th year. After the Israelites came out of Egypt, Aaron was 123 years old when he died on Mount Hor.
Go ahead.
And King Arad, the Canaanite, which dwelt in the south, in the land of Canaan, heard of the coming of the children of Israel. And they departed from Mount Hor and pitched in Salmonah. And they departed from Salmonah and fished in Ponon. And they departed from Ponon and fished in Oboth. And they departed from Oboth and fished in near Abarim, in the border of Moab. And they departed from Lim and fished in Gibbon-Gad. And they removed from the Pongad and encamped in Arnon Diplathaim.
Diplathaim.
They departed from Arnon Diplathaim and pitched in the mountains of Abarim before Nebo. And they departed from mountains of Abarim and pitched in the plains of Moab by Jordan near over Jordan into the land of Canaan, then we shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you, and destroy all their pictures, and destroy all their molten images, and quite pluck down all their high places. And we shall dispose the inhabitants of the land and dwell therein, for I have given you the land to possess it. And ye shall divide the land by lot for an inheritance among your families, and to the more ye shall give, the more in inheritance, and to the fewer ye shall give, the less inheritance. Every man's inheritance shall be in the place where his lot falleth, according to the tribe of your fathers ye shall inherit. But if ye will not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall come to pass that those which ye let remain of them shall be pricks in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and shall vex you in the land wherein ye dwell. Moreover, it shall come to pass that I shall do unto you as I thought to do unto them. Mm-hmm. Shall I go to 34?
No, that's good.
That's it.
Great. No, I mean, 33 is good. We're just to the end of there. Okay, so what is this chapter about? What can we say? The journeys. It's a summary of the journeys and how they marched. And so...
in great detail, so that it's sort of historical.
It's a record. It's, yeah. They want you to know
also
exactly...
The distance, you could probably calculate the distance.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have other records of their travels, which may or may not be identical to this. But why... it's very interesting, like, why list it now? And I was trying to think, you know, numbers. We've been reading through Numbers a while. And I don't... You probably... Our visitors maybe haven't been reading it like we have been the last few months. But what would you say the feeling is you get from the whole book of Numbers? How is Israel represented according to this book?
I was going to say by numbers, but...
Okay, numbers is definitely a big theme.
Yeah.
But when do you need to know how many people you have? Why would that be important?
Because it would... That's a good question. About what accommodation... I mean, when I say accommodation,
mm-hmm.
but it's not like outcome... What accommodation you want, and how much land
yeah.
you need to put.
Okay, so there's a practical aspect that we just read. The one who has a lot of children, you need more land, right? So the one who has a lot, you give a bigger land. The one who has less, you give less. But the other time, normally when kings
battles.
When you count,
yeah.
when you count people, it's to so that the king knows how big is my army.
Yeah.
You know you. You count your weapons, you count your people, and that's how you know, like, do I have what it takes to do this? So the interesting thing with numbers is that the story of leaving Egypt is really told like an army, like God's army. And so there, in the very beginning of the book, it's like the camp. You know, in an army, you have to be very organized, and everybody has their duties, and... There's a strict order. And so the whole book spends a lot of time saying, you know, which person is carrying what and where they're going to camp. And so you have this picture of a very large, organized army of people.
I never thought about it that way. It seemed like ritual, all the religious ritual stuff, but it's all actually being carried as well.
Yes.
And then eventually placed. And it does sound like the military.
Yeah.
The military is very... obsessively mean because everything is counted.
Everything is counted, and you need also for speed, right? If you're going to do something efficiently, everybody needs to know what they're going to do, what their job is. And so it's very detailed, like this family is going to camp here, this, then this one, then this one. Your jobs are to carry this part of the tabernacle so that when you say, you know, now we're moving, everyone goes, gets their things, and
you have a large family, and you allow anyone any kind of, oh, you have disaster and chaos, you know, that
true
family.
Yeah.
So the rules and regulations would really help things
to operate, yeah.
And to know who, you know, to
who is responsible.
A hierarchy so that people could relax, to not worry about the other guys, what they had, you know, less friction.
Yeah. And
God's a very practical God, then, you know, that's
he is
important to him. Whereas sometimes we think people who, I don't know, we've got an order sometimes, oh, they're just a cleaner, or they just tidy up after. But it's very important to God,
it is,
isn't it?
And the cleaners are very important.
Yeah, but we don't always look at it like that, do we? We all, let's go and hear so-and-so speak, you know, and someone who just does, when I say just as the clean, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, Paul talked about it in the New Testament, too, how there's different vessels. You know, you have fancy things in your house, and you have less fancy, but they're all important.
Yeah.
If you didn't have a toilet, for instance, it would not be pleasant to live in anyone's house.
No.
And so that toilet, although it's not fancy, is very, very important. And everybody has their job, and each one is important. The other parallels to army, we have the a flag and a standard, which is normally military talk, that each tribe has a picture, and we don't know what it is anymore. There are some ideas from medieval commentaries came up with ideas based on the blessings found in the book of Genesis, what type of picture may have been on each tribe. But it's interesting. It kind of reminds you either today maybe of Harry Potter, but also, you know, armies. You have, like the Romans, they had their legions with their numbers, and they had the what do you call it, eagle, and so everybody, you know, you kind of have a picture that represents you. So that's very much like army. And then counting, they counted people from age 20 and up, which is later on when you go out to army, you also find these census. It's from age 20 and up, and but that in numbers is for serving in the tabernacle as well. So there's this direct parallel between army age and serving God in the tabernacle.
But I never thought about it in terms of the friction and working together part of it. I thought about it. When you read it, it seems so obsessively, you know, the details. But actually, if you're going to have kind of peace, you need to have that level of organization.
Absolutely.
Where there's going to be, but oh, that should be mine, this should be yours, this isn't good enough. You know, all kinds of trouble.
Yeah, it's true.
I never thought about the
Yeah, it's very important that everybody knows what they're meant to be doing so that the whole thing functions. And if you take large amounts of people through anywhere, you know, you need that kind of organization, especially if you're taking them through places that aren't so easy to live in, like the wilderness, which may or may not have water. It may or may not have this or that. So it's a huge feat.
You know, they don't have, like, they're going to, God's telling them where to go and which people to attack and not attack and how. They don't really actually know anything about
Right.
And the situation, the people, the numbers, any of it.
And that's why it's all the more important to
obey.
Yeah. And to have an order that you know to obey. Before we go to the Isaiah thing, I also want to look at a couple of these phrases in here. There is one phrase. Let's see, if you look in verse 3. It also, you notice numbers tells you what time of the year they left. That was important to them.
And the day.
In the first month, on the 15th day of the first month. Okay, so the month of the years in the old system, when did the year begin in the old biblical system?
Before the Passover?
Basically, Passover time. It was springtime. Was the beginning of the year.
April.
Yeah. So we have two ways of counting months in the old biblical Hebrew, and we found it also outside of biblical texts as well. In Gezer, they found a calendar, and it's an agricultural calendar. And there are some names in that calendar that we don't have in the Bible. The normal system in the Bible is to count the numbers just first, second, third, fourth, you know, throughout the year. So the first would start in spring. We also have the name of a couple of the months. So Aviv, today is how we refer to spring, and that would have been the first month. But later, the Israelites went to Babylon, and there was a different system there. And they started in the fall, and they had different names of the month. And after living there, they actually used the names of the month, just like today here in this land. They refer to, now you can call it November, November. So they have, well, they now they have two systems. They have the Jewish calendar and the, what they call the...
Gregorian.
Yeah, it is a Gregorian, but here they call it the Ezrahi, like the citizen, in the sense that it's the secular calendar, so to speak. So you can refer to both November and you can refer to Kislev, or the Jewish. But the irony is that the Jewish calendar of today is actually not so Jewish, it's Babylonian, or at least the names. The names are Babylonian and they were adopted. Similarly, today, you know, our names come from the Greeks, and they were adopted. And then once they're in place, you know, they get continued.
And during the Germans, they encountered wars.
They counted wars?
Wars, yes.
Yes, absolutely. And that ties into this theme of being the Lord's army. Like, you actually have to fight some wars as well. That's part of it. Certain tasks, except the Levites, their service is to serve in the temple instead of in the army. But yeah, so it's important for the book of Numbers that they're leaving the day after Passover. And there's one other thing that's very interesting to me. Look at the end of verse 3 in Numbers 33. What does your Bible say?
They marched out boldly.
Okay, yeah. So mine says defiantly.
Oh, yeah. Okay, boldly.
The Israelites went out defiantly in plain sight of all the Egyptians. So in Hebrew it says, the children of Israel went out with a lifted hand before the eyes of the Egyptians. So now we have a question. What does this phrase with a lifted hand mean? Beyad Rama. And you could see, because they come together, that before, in sight of the Egyptians, could be a way of explaining what a lifted hand means. But curiously, this phrase only comes, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4. It only comes 4 times in the Bible. Yad Rama.
When I'm defiantly is.
Yeah.
Right.
And defiant. I don't know. What translations do you have over here?
New King James, I bet. It says, boldness.
Yeah.
Bold.
Yeah.
Yad Rama. And what's Rama? Is raised arm. Yad is arm.
Yeah. Yad is hand or arm. Rama is lifted. Okay. So lifted hand. Literally, and it's only 3 times. Okay, so we have boldly. To be defiant, is this a good thing or a bad thing?
We would say not a good thing.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing.
Because if a child is defiant, they're defying authority.
Yeah, you're
so
going against something.
That's right, we wouldn't look at that as a...
Now, yeah.
As a quality to be... encourage, let's put it that way.
The only way defiant would be good is if the authority were a bad authority, maybe.
Yeah.
You can defy someone doing the wrong thing.
Yeah. Yeah,
so maybe if you were defiant to Hitler, that would be perceived as okay.
Yeah.
But it is interesting, and so that's why I wanted to...
The Lord ordered that, and he tells them to go out, because it's provocative, too.
Okay, so here's the question. Why does he write this here at all? Why, first of all, what does it mean to go out defiantly from Egypt? And why does he write it? And I think when like Numbers, the book of Numbers doesn't tell you the story of leaving Egypt. It starts from when they've already left. But we do have the story in Exodus. And if you just remember back, when and how did they leave Egypt?
Well, the Egyptians told them to go, didn't they?
Yes and no, right? Pharaoh was saying no.
And
he finally said yes because
of
the firstborn being killed.
Until that happened, they never said go.
Right, and do you remember?
They had no idea they would also rescind that.
Well, did they have no idea? Because when he said, fine, go, get out, it was like immediately, get out now.
Yeah, it had enough.
And yet they're collecting jewelry from their neighbors.
Yeah. But it's kind of, it is painted, it's described as they had no time to let their dough raise,
That's sudden.
And what else? If you remember, it's like in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
So it's nighttime, and it's sudden. Normally, when you hear nighttime and sudden, I mean, you think of a thief breaking in at night, right? It's something people don't know about. It kind of happens when you're half awake, and is this really happening? It's very chaotic.
It's very strange, because your child has just died, and you give these people jewelry.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like a fear of...
Because they didn't know what else might happen.
Yes, exactly. It's like, I recognize
there is
such a big power behind you. And remember, this is a pagan mindset. So, you know, there's all these powers at work. Maybe I can buy it off, you know, if I give you gold and silver, something that kind of like saves me.
Yeah.
And that's it doesn't have to be true for it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't know if somebody else was going to die in the family today.
Yeah,
right.
Sure.
So go now, go, take this.
They had to be very slowly impressed with the power of God. You know, like many things happened. Eventually, I guess, they really
Pharaoh maybe was the most stubborn, and it took all the way for his firstborn to die before he's willing to admit you have more power than me. But some of Pharaoh's servants, if you remember in the plague of, in the hail. Remember hail, plague 8? Where Moses and Aaron say, if you believe, like there's going to be this destruction, get your stuff out of the field.
Yeah.
And it mentions that some of Pharaoh's officials actually did that.
Did it? Yeah.
They were starting to believe that, hey, these people really have power behind them. We better obey. And the ones that were out of the field were spared.
Yes.
So it's interesting that people, we don't know what the average person living in Egypt was thinking already, but we know that Pharaoh was the one that was stubborn until the end, and he was causing destruction on his people because he was so stubborn. And I think this happens to all big leaders, like, what's the word called? Dictators, you know? They stop thinking about their people, and it's all about their pride. And the average person may have long time ago been willing to change so they could have just peace and a normal life, but the leaders don't. And so, unfortunately, they cause trouble. But what I see, if you compare the picture in Exodus of this chaotic
going out,
it's in the middle of the night, it's like thieves. Like, think about slaves, right? When would you leave as a slave? Maybe in the middle of the night, right? Maybe you're running away. And so to me, Numbers wants to make clear that this isn't just slaves running away in the middle of the night. This is something that everybody knew about. Everybody saw it. They did it in full knowledge. You know, they're not just refugee slaves. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And how do you see the connection there?
The connection is by the sacrifice of Jesus, the lamb that was.
Yeah, like the Passover lamb.
They could leave. They could leave the bondage.
Yeah.
That he came to free the bondage, as I said, prophecy about Jesus. So
okay.
His first appearance into the mind of people, it's by sacrifice, blood sacrifice,
mm-hmm.
which is Jesus' sacrifice.
Yeah, for sure. There are many parallels between Passover and Jesus, and John particularly points to those. Even, you know, that Jesus' bones not be broken like a Passover lamb. And the day of the Passover in John is when Jesus is on the cross. But before that, back to this whole image of Yad Ramah, it's something deliberate. It's something that's planned. It's not an accident. It's not just, oh, these slaves got away. There's like a grand plan, and it's purposeful, and it's obvious. It's not by chance.
It's victorious.
It's victorious is what it is. It's a completely different picture. Yeah. Now, just to solidify this Yad Ramah boldly, defiantly, let's quickly look at Numbers 15:30. Okay, normally, well, in this phrase, in Numbers 15:30, it's a bad thing to have a high lifted hand, because it's something deliberately defiant, and here you're defying God, and it's arrogant. It's like as if they're going to attack God, or if they're going against him.
Is that the same expression?
It's the same expression, Biyad Ramah. But in this case, you're going against a good authority, which is God's, and you know the law, but you're not going to do it on purpose. So again, it's that sense of deliberate, I'm not doing this on purpose. It's very obvious. And so in this case, when you sin that way, you're told that you'll be cut off from your people. Now, there's one more place this comes, and that's Deuteronomy 32:27. And this is in Moses' song, so it's poetry. I'll read my translation in the NET Bible. But I fear the reaction of their enemies, for their adversaries would misunderstand and say, our power is great. That's our hand is lifted, literally. And the Lord has not done this at all.
It's interesting because in my translation it says, our hand has triumphed.
Our hand has triumphed. So again, let's write this up.
Power is great. Victory, oh, right, or victorious. So, in two contexts, this is actually portrayed as something bad. In our context as Numbers, I think it's portrayed as something good, but it's a symbol of a lot of power, great power, and victorious. And so again, it ties into this theme of, we're going out as a victorious army of the Lord. In Deuteronomy 32, verse 27, lest they should say, it says, yeah. The enemy is going to say, Yadenu Rama, or Yadenu Rama here, our hand is lifted up, and not God did this. So here's a contrast. Not only is our hand lifted up, but God didn't do this. So our hand lifted up means we did it, we conquered, we're powerful.
When you think of somebody who wins in an election, what do they do with their hands often?
Like, yeah, it's a very, like, the symbol is like, yeah. I'm winning, yeah. And we have a similar phrase in Psalm 89:14, where the psalmist says of God, your arm is powerful, your hand is strong, your right hand is victorious. And there, it uses the verb, instead of Yad Ramah, it says Yadcha Tarum. Your hand will be up. So it's a related phrase. And your right hand being up is translated here victorious. Like you're going to win. You have the power. So again, it's a military symbol, really. And it's a symbol of power. Okay. So in Numbers, it's important for the writer to let us know that this happened as part of God's plan. He's leading a people out as a big victorious army, and it's not a bunch of runaway slaves, and there's order and there's power as they follow his instructions, obviously. And there's a place for each person. So let's look back really quickly at Numbers 33. What else? Also, towards the end, there is, after the whole description, of course, it's important for battle's sake to know where you've been through all the stations. It specifically mentions Aaron's death and Moses, because they were the big leaders. And we know that they didn't come into the land. And so in verse 50 to the end, it gives us their perception of Moses' last words to the people. And this is what you have to know, like when you cross over the Jordan into Canaan, into Canaan. It's really important that you get rid of all idol worship. And so God is saying, you need to get rid of the inhabitants because of the idol worship. And of course, we remember not too many chapters ago where we had a big problem with the Moabite and Midianite women coming and leading Israel astray. So here there's a reminder, you definitely have to clear out the people, because the people, there's no chance that the people won't influence you, basically.
That's a hard one.
That is a hard one.
Well, I find it so new.
For sure.
It is hard.
And I think the Bible also deals with the hardness of this, because even as they're coming in the land, they always pray to God. There's never one directive, like, go in and just kill everybody everywhere. Every time they come to a city, Joshua has to pray and say, okay, what am I supposed to do here? And it's different every time. And we do have people who join God. People are actually given a chance, like Rahab and her family, and who knows what other people.
Yeah.
So that's another whole interesting question. But the bottom line is that the emphasis is on the idolatry. It's very, very important that they don't leave worship of God to worship something else. What does it remind you of? The two things, if you don't get rid of the inhabitants, what will they be for you?
Thorns in your sides.
Yeah.
It would be a pain in the neck.
A pain in the neck. That's another metaphor
in
English that we would say. So these are also interesting little phrases. Sikim b'einichem. Yeah. To me, it reminds me of Paul again. He had some type of problem. We don't know what. And how did he describe it? He prays three times. A thorn?
A thorn in his side. In the eyes it was.
In the eyes or the side?
Or the sides.
Or the flesh? So it reminds me here, this thorns, sninim it is here, sninim betzidechem, of thorns in your side, where something that is constantly bothering you and you can't get rid of it. And there is the last verse in 56, the last verse of the chapter. What I intended to do to them, I will do to you. So again, like, even bringing into the land and possessing the land, it does demand obedience. And if not, the same thing can happen to you that happened to the other people. You know, if they're not worshiping God and you decide to join them, then, you know, you can be kicked out of the land too. So it's quite a powerful last word Moses is giving. Okay, so we're going to go to Isaiah 11:16. Oops. There we are. And we will read some verses. Now we know this is a famous chapter because it deals with a stump of Jesse, that there's going to be a new growth out of this stump, and the netzer is going to come out of his roots. Of course, if you've been here, you see the olive tree. You've all seen the olive tree, and then by the roots, there's like little branches, the netzer. So that's a nice picture. Even if you cut the olive tree off, you can get then the new growth. And so it's both a picture of redemption, but a tree got cut off. You know, that's a serious thing. Anyway, this is a very famous passage. And then we have a picture of an ideal situation where you're basically returning to the Garden of Eden, where a wolf and a lamb can dwell together because everybody's eating grass again. And then you have this idea of this Messiah figure from the root of Jesse that's going to be a signal flag for the nations. And again, that signal and flag is something from war. And they're going to gather all the people together that have been in all these other big areas. Okay. So let's read in verse 16. Would you like to start?
Yeah. And there shall be an highway for the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, like as it was to Israel in the day that he came up out of the land of Egypt.
It's the end of the chapter.
Very end of the chapter, yeah.
Is it the
well, go ahead and read. Yes, it's the same in Hebrew here, the very end of the chapter. But go ahead and start the next part.
And in that day, thou shalt say, O Lord, I will praise thee, though thou art was angry with me, thine anger is turned away, and thou comfortest me. Behold, God is my salvation.
From a distant land?
Which
yeah, that's probably a good place to stop.
Okay.
It's describing a judgment day of the Lord, but how is it picturing this? Do you notice some connections here?
Some of the warriors yeah. Posting arrogant ones. So those are my own.
Yeah.
Okay,
so first there's a direct, in the first verse we read, which is the last verse of Isaiah 11, there's this highway from Assyria, just as it was in Israel the day or the time they came out from Egypt. So I have a question. When Israelites came out of Egypt, did they use the highway? There was a highway.
They didn't
use the highway. Why not? Why did God say, don't follow the highway?
Because, wasn't it, they could get entrapped in what was going
on.
Well,
there would have been Egyptian stations all along the highway, first of all.
Yeah.
But God says, because if they face war right now, they're going to chicken out and go back. And he didn't want them to panic and be afraid, so he leads them through the desert instead.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that here in Isaiah he's saying, just like Egypt, they're gonna, you know, there's gonna be this highway, and all these people are gonna come back. But actually, when they left Egypt, they didn't use the highway. However, this is how it connects to me to our passage in Numbers. They did leave, according to Numbers, as a big organized army, and they did leave Beyad Ramah, where everybody saw it was not slaves running away. It was an organized. Everybody knows this. We're leaving. And so in that sense, it's similar to just getting up on a highway where everyone can see you. It's in full knowledge of everybody. And it's victorious. It's a victorious leaving. And so Numbers is the one that shows us this leaving of Egypt as a victorious thing. And so I think that's how it connects for us with Isaiah. And Isaiah continues about God, of course, his anger subsiding means this is going to be after they've been kicked out of the land and they're coming back from Assyria. And so when your anger subsided, God's going to be deliverance. Look again at verse 2 of Isaiah 12. What does it remind you of? It says, "For ki ozi vezimratia Adonai vahili lishua," because my strength and the song of God is the Lord. He's become my salvation. Psalm? What? It's from a song.
Yeah, but not those words.
This is a quote. Where do you get this quote in the Bible? I'm thinking Old Testament, because it's quoting Hebrew, from Hebrew.
It comes in
Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
We have beautiful songs about this. Nobody remembers?
It's in a song, surely.
It's in a song, one of the oldest songs we have in the Hebrew Bible. Not the oldest, but one of the older ones. In fact, I would say maybe it's the first song in the Bible. The first psalm. Exodus 15. You look there. Moses sings a song. Why does he sing a song? It's a deliverance. It's a victory song. And it's specifically the victory after coming out of Egypt. They part the waters, right?
Yeah.
God parts the waters of the sea. And then they pass through and they sing this song next in Exodus 15, verse 1. Then Moses and the Israelites sang this song to the Lord. They said, "I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and its rider he has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him, my father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a warrior. The Lord is his name." And it goes on and on, and it sings a song about what's happened. And, of course, if you skip down to verse 6, "Your right hand, O Lord, was majestic in power. Your right hand, O Lord, shattered the enemy." So, again, you have this picture of a hand as triumphant and victorious. So, not only did Isaiah talk about this future coming back of Israel and compare it to the previous leaving of Egypt, the Exodus, but he's also borrowing a direct quote from that older song about this victory that's going to happen. And God is going to become salvation for the people. He's going to do it. I've just lost my place. Wait, let me find Isaiah again. Yes. So back to Isaiah. He is the God of my salvation. I will trust in him and I will not be afraid because he is my strength and my song, and God has become my salvation. And then you will draw waters with joy from the wells of salvation, and you will say in that day, praise be to God, call on his name, tell all the people his actions, basically, what he's done. And mention his name because his name is high and exalted. Sing to the Lord, and it uses here, ge'ut asa. Ge'ut is something high. It can be pride, but it can also be just glory and power. And in the Exodus psalm, you also have ki ga'o ga'a. He is done victoriously or gloriously. That's the same word. And everybody in all the peoples of the lands know it. And so sing out, cry out, you who sit in Zion, because the great God is in your midst, the Holy One of Israel. And then it goes on. And again, it's this picture of an army. And God is the commander of the army, and he's raising a flag. And notice he's waving his hand, he's shouting to people to come. And then you have direct reference in verse 3. I have commanded my holy ones, my holy people, or the people who've been sanctified, and I have called them, what? Giborai, my mighty warriors. Or here you have my chosen soldiers. I don't know where they got the... I guess they were combining, my translation combines the idea of being sanctified and being called a soldier at the same thing. But it's almost here, it's a picture of a holy war. I hate to use that phrase because there's so many other people that have used that phrase in a bad way. But the idea that you've been set apart, you've been sanctified, you're listening to God, and he is leading you as if in a war. And you are a warrior. So really, that is those are the connections I see. And I think that if you look at the big picture, it goes back to who is in control. It's not, when you're in the army, you don't get to decide whether you go there or there. You have to obey the commander. And so if God is in control, it's not you. And God is the one, again, this whole picture of the army is not to show your strength and power. It's really just God's strength and power. And he's still the one in control. And so when he does these things and we obey, if we are the people of God and hear his voice and obey, it's like we are bringing him glory as the majestic commander of an army. So we can think about those things. I know our world is a little different. And even just thinking about being part of an army is maybe different for some people, depending where you're coming from. But there's definitely that picture here of God as being ultimately mighty and ultimately in control. And he leads his army in a way that's beautiful, even brings glory.
And maybe if they were all obedient, that would have been like Jericho. It would have been that,
yeah,
I'm giving you this land, and people will just leave.
Right.
I've sovereignly shown them that this mm-hmm. land is for you.
Right.
I'm the biggest guy. So
yeah. Yeah, or you know, more people like Rahav in Jericho, yeah. Like, she recognized that, and she says such beautiful words. It's amazing what she understood. And just by seeing God work, like, she understood these things. So it's quite amazing. And that ties us up to the Christmas season, because if you go home and read Matthew's genealogy, you will notice that Rahab is mentioned. And it's not by accident. Like, normally, you don't mention the women in genealogies. If the only reason they're there is if there's something significant about them. And I think the four women mentioned, if you go and you think about their stories and you go back and read them, I mean, this is a whole nother study, but you will see beautiful statements of faith that it kind of shows you that God can bring anyone into his family who has that kind of faith and is willing to acknowledge who God is. And so it's very beautiful for those of us, I don't know who is here today, but I personally, I'm not Jewish, but I am part of God's family. And you're brought in through faith and not just who your father is. So that's very powerful. Okay, so Shabbat Shalom, and you can make your way downstairs.